This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 31st, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Big Deal feature, International Olympic Committee member Dick Pound talks the business of sport, the politics of sport, and the integrity of sport, and the Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is the NDP's affordable BC strategy starting to wear thin? April 1st means life gets more expensive in BC, from the cost of auto insurance to electricity. Sure, the Horgan Horde did kill bridge tolls for the Port Man, and they did introduce some much-needed help for some of the poorest in the province who were neglected by the BC Liberals. The transition year for the medical insurance plan, however, means retailers and local governments have been passing on the hikes to Joe and Jane Q. Public. The carbon tax is going up $5 to $40 per ton, which means higher prices at the gas pumps and higher prices for anything that gets delivered. It will mean higher prices for groceries. The Land Title and Survey Authority of BC, the statutory monopoly that keeps track of who owns real estate, is hiking the price of a property search. Last July, it stopped providing the first owner's name on title for free. The NDP has done nothing to look for savings, to stop spending waste. Heck, they even started to run partisan ads that are critical of BC Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson. They promised they wouldn't do that. No wonder they say that BC means bring cash. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Unas Aladin reports, "Uncivilized, shameful, and scandalous. Shuzhou marathon marred by bizarre behavior." Last weekend's marathon staged in China's Jiangsu province attracted scorn, both on and off the track, with a woman runner brazenly using a bicycle during the marathon, while there were cases of looting from bystanders after boxes of bananas and water bottles placed along the race route were taken away for personal consumption. Organizers banned the bike-riding female runner for life after she was seen several times riding a rented green-colored bike along the route on her way to finishing the marathon in 5 hours, 38 minutes, and 36 seconds. The runner, who was surnamed Meng, could face further punishment from China's Athletics Association after violating the rules. At last November's half marathon in Shenzhen, 258 runners were caught cheating by taking shortcuts and wearing fake bibs. A video of the scandal went viral. On ABC Australia, Eddie Maguire forced to apologize after mocking double amputee Cynthia Banham's coin toss. Journalist, author, solicitor, and teacher Banham, who lost both of her legs in a 2007 plane crash in Indonesia which killed 21 people, performed the pre-match ritual before the March 29th Australian Rules fixture between Sydney and Adelaide. She held on to her walking stick while fulfilling the duty. "I think we should introduce a $5,000 fine to anybody who's tossing the coin and can't do it properly," Maguire said while commenting on Fox Footy. Maguire later apologized unreservedly. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Shane Dixon Kavanaugh reports, "Saudi students escaping U.S. justice. Video shows brutal bar attack. Porsche getaway." A group of young men in Toledo, Ohio, had stabbed McWaters repeatedly in the head with a broken pool cue outside a college bar during a brawl, according to witnesses and surveillance video of the 2015 incident. At least two others besides McWaters needed hospital attention. Police arrested four men on suspicion of assault. All were from Saudi Arabia. But when McWaters arrived at Toledo Municipal Court in early August 2015, he learned they would likely never face prosecution. The men had fled the country only a day after a company that does business with the Saudi government bailed them out with a $100,000 surety bond. The case is the latest of now nearly two dozen identified by the Oregonian, where Saudi nationals accused of serious crimes, including manslaughter and rape, have vanished while under criminal investigation or awaiting trial. Federal law enforcement officials and prosecutors believe Saudi officials directly helped defendants escape in at least two of them. In the Bellingham Herald, Denver Pratt reports, three Blaine Middle School students suspended over racist graffiti in school bathroom. Three white Blaine Middle School students were suspended this week for writing racist graffiti on a school bathroom wall, while two black students were in the stalls, police say. All five were coming from a class discussing the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Shortly after 12:30 p.m. on March 26th, Blaine police were called to Blaine Middle School for the report of a hate crime. When the two black students went into the bathroom stalls, the three white students wrote "whites only" in green permanent marker on the wall, thinking it would be funny, according to Sergeant Michael Munden with the Blaine Police Department. And last week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. Legislature law clerk acted for Craig James in a personal matter. NDP breaks 2017 campaign promise to end partisan government ads. And it's brutal. BCLC calls spin doctors for help amid casino money laundering scandal. Read the stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Dick Pound is a lawyer, accountant, and author, a squash player and swimmer who spent part of his childhood in Ocean Falls, BC. He was later on Canada's Rome 1960 Olympic swim team. The outspoken Canadian is the doyen, or the most senior member, of the International Olympic Committee. Pound was instrumental in the commercialization of world sport as negotiator of Olympic broadcast and sponsorship agreements. The 77-year-old was also a founder of the Montreal-based World Anti-Doping Agency and was its first president. Pound is in Vancouver for the American Bar Association conference and to speak to the Canadian Club Vancouver on April 1st at the Terminal City Club. For more information about the lunch, go to CanadianClubVancouver.com. On March 28th, I sat down with Dick Pound for an in-depth interview about the business, politics, and integrity of world sport. Here is part one of that interview. Fewer cities are bidding for the Olympics because of the high cost of building venues, the high cost of security, and the high potential for corruption. The 1988 Winter Olympics host, Calgary, was bidding for the 2026 Winter Olympics, but its bid was defeated in last fall's plebiscite. That left Italy and Sweden in the running. Many Calgarians voted no after looking at the costs and the secrecy of the Vancouver 2010 Games. I asked Dick Pound what went wrong with the Calgary bid.
Well, the whole Calgary thing, that could have been a winner for everybody, including the Olympic movement, instead of what they're going through now. But it was so badly managed. It's as if, he said, how can we screw this up so that we don't get it? And, I mean, nobody took any leadership. The only ones who were really good about it and who ended up getting crap from the mayor were the feds. The province was only going to do something because there's an election coming up and they need some votes out of Calgary as well as Edmonton and other areas, but they were not enthusiastic. And the mayor, you never got him to embrace this. You're the leader. Stop looking at the polls and say, this is going to be good for Calgary. I'm behind it. My council's behind it. Let's go and get this. And we'll figure out how to make it work. Anyway, I feel like the old Saturday Night Live thing is, don't get me started.
Beijing hosted the 2008 Summer Olympics, as many world leaders hoped that it would help China open up and become more democratic someday. But, more than a decade later, there is more censorship and more surveillance in China. Journalists, lawyers, and academics who question Beijing's authority often wind up in jail. In 2022, Beijing will also host the Winter Olympics.
And these questions will only get louder as we get closer, and wonder if China will ever loosen its grip and become a freer society.
It's a difficult country. In fact, I always remember the discussion that Nixon had with Mao, saying, you know, you've done amazing things with this. He said, well, he said, I should tell you that once you get 100 miles outside of Beijing, I don't control China. It's still, there are all these separate, whatever you would call them, run by barons of, it's not an easy problem to solve. And I think if they get bombarded by all of the Western media and so on, it'll be impossible to control. And I think they see, like the Tiananmen Square thing, they just see the whole structure crumbling if it gets out of control. So they're trying to manage some kind of change. It's arguably somewhat better, but I mean, there'll always be a Tibet, there'll always be groups, there'll always be re-education programming. Our colleague in the IOC was a distinguished academic planting rice while being re-educated. I mean, his hands were a mess after that. Cold water and all that. Anyway, there will be paroxysms like that, and we're seeing it all around the world now. As you know, everyone's moving.
Last December, China made arbitrary arrests of two Canadians in retaliation for the arrest in Vancouver of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. A trade dispute over canola has erupted. Canada's former ambassador to China, Guy St. Jake, suggested that Canada expel all Chinese athletes who are training in Canada.
Would that be a viable move for Canada?
I would be uncomfortable with using athletes as hostages in something like that. I mean, we kind of were in the Moscow boycott. and the outrage of Canada for the invasion of Afghanistan was so acute that we cut down the Aeroflot flights to Canada from 4 per week to 3 per week. We canceled a ballet tour. We sold more wheat than ever in our history, and we boycotted the Olympics. And that was just, disemboweling your own athletes for no purpose whatsoever. I mean, the Soviet Union was not going to get out of Afghanistan with a Jimmy Carter state. I mean, it's one thing to get into a country, you can do that in a hurry, but you're in Afghanistan and you're trying to get out again, assuming you want to, that's not so easy. I think that lesson has been learned by politicians. I mean, the boycotts have pretty well fallen off the table. Certainly, in 1984, there was a retaliatory boycott. When Gromykov and Andropov died, and Chernenko came in. He was more dead than alive, and he was under the thumb of Gromyko, who hated the United States. So you knew there was going to be a boycott. But we got onto it better than we did in Montreal, for example, and better than we did in 1980. And they couldn't even hold the Warsaw Pact countries together, Yugoslavia and Romania. Competed, and the Chinese came for the first time, and they were the darlings of the crowd. By the time it came to the possibility of a boycott in Seoul, the IOC took charge of it. They said, politicians really don't give a shit about the Olympics. We're just a bargaining chip. We'll solve it. And Samaranch was brilliant. He said, this is an Olympic family discussion. there's now a proposal on the table for co-hosting North and South. We're in charge of the Olympics. This is an Olympic matter. Come to Lausanne, we'll talk about it. And he persuaded the South Koreans to let him do the negotiations. And it was all looked like, on the surface, it was a sport thing. It was the deadliest politics. I mean, dramatic and important for both countries. And he managed it. And he said to the South Koreans, don't worry. There will never be any games in North Korea. What we need to do is keep this ball up in the air so that all of the so-called non-aligned countries realize we're taking their allies seriously. We're bargaining with them. And it will become apparent that the problem is North Korea. It's not South Korea. It's not the IOC. And sure enough, I forget when it was, easy to find out, but I mean, 6 or so months before the games, Soviet Union opens a consulate in Seoul, the first time ever. And that was a message saying, don't you guys fuck this up, because we're going to be there. And China did its part the same way. So anyway, you can get there if you have enlightened and subtle people running the process.
Athletes are coming forward about harassment and bullying by their coaches and the support staff, from USA Gymnastics to members of Canada's 2008 Women's Olympic Soccer Program. They're speaking out. Dick Pound was instrumental in the formation of the World Anti-Doping Agency to crack down on athletes who use drugs to cheat. I asked Dick Pound if it is time for World Sport to establish an agency like WADA that protects athletes from abuse and protects sport from corruption.
Well, that's certainly a model you can think of. My gut reaction is that, you know, soccer knows more about soccer than an umbrella organization, and you know, swimming knows more about swimming than, and it's probably there that it should happen, but there certainly can be governance standards. But you say, you know, these are the minimum things you've got to have in place, and do. And we can, the IOC is now starting to, you know, stick its nose into boxing, which it should have done years ago, but say, you know, listen, this is not good for you or for us, so if you don't clean it up, maybe you should sit out on the sidelines for a while. I did that it happened before the Ben Johnson thing, but I said to Sam Rash, I said, you know, we're getting off this doping headlines. I said, but you know, 60 or 70% of the positive doping cases come from this one dinky little sport called weightlifting. And so I've got a meeting with, you know, the Bob of the day, and I'm going to suggest that, you know, weightlifting is a wonderful, traditional, exciting, emotional sport, but it's got a problem. And we should help it deal with the problem. And probably the best thing to do would be to say, take a rest from the Olympics until you get this, you know, under control. And then, you know, there are ways of solving it. And I said, now, 5 minutes after Bob of the Day hears this, you're going to start getting calls from the weightlifting people. And I said, you have to decide what you do with them. But I mean, one of the things is say, well, it does sound a little extreme, but you know, I think an early vice president at that point. He's the younger IOC crowd, and help me to help you. What are you going to do? And they changed all their weight classification. I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. So there are no more tainted world records. But anyway, got ramped up again, and now they're still in the shit.
That was part one of my feature interview with International Olympic Committee member Dick Pound. Pound speaks to the Canadian Club Vancouver on April 1st at the Terminal City Club. For more information about the noon event, go to CanadianClubVancouver.com.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau. Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
Hello.
Hello, Michael. It's Jody.
Hi. Sorry about the phone tag.
That's okay.
And so begins the recording of a 17-minute phone call between then-Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould and the Clerk of the Privy Council, Michael Wernick, from December 19, 2018. It is the phone call that Canada is talking about, after it was released March 29th by the House of Commons Justice Committee. The Majority Liberal Justice Committee voted the previous week to shut down its investigation of the SNC-Lavalin scandal and not hear more testimony from Wilson-Raybould. It is yet more evidence of the campaign by the Prime Minister's office to pressure Wilson-Raybould, the Vancouver-Granville Liberal MP, to reverse a decision to prosecute SNC-Lavalin for bribery and corruption instead of negotiate a plea bargain under a new law to penalize companies. Wilson-Raybould resigned from cabinet on February 12th. The SNC-Lavalin scandal is now stretching into a fourth month. Here are some of the highlights of Wilson-Raybould's recording of Michael Wernick.
And I know the jobs are important, so I don't want anybody to misinterpret that I don't care about those jobs. This is about the integrity of the government and recognizing that there is the ability to issue a directive under the Act. It is still irrespective of the ability of that I have to do that. One, it's never been done before. But two, this is going to look like nothing but political interference by the Prime Minister, by you, by everybody else that's been involved in this, politically pressuring me to do this.
Well,
I actually really feel uncomfortable having this conversation. You know what? I hope that you do, because I don't think anybody respects this. I mean, the conversation that Jerry and Katie had with my chief of staff, and I have it, like, she wrote down what they said, like saying that they don't want to have anything or hear any more about the legalities, but want to talk about jobs. Entirely inappropriate.
All right. I'm going to have to report back before he leaves. He's in a pretty firm frame of mind about this, though, so I'm a bit worried.
A bit worried about what?
Well, it's not a good idea for the Prime Minister and his Attorney General to be at loggerheads.
Well, I feel that I'm giving him my best advice. And if he doesn't accept that advice, then it's his prerogative to do what he wants. But I am trying to protect the Prime Minister from political interference or perceived or otherwise.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks for calling me back so quickly.
No problem.
And, we'll see. He's still around tomorrow.
I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, so I'm not under any illusion how the Prime Minister has and gets things that he wants, and I'm just stuck doing the best job that I can.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Talk again.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No! Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Andy Yan, the director of Simon Fraser University's City Program, who has earned the nickname the Duke of Data. While Vancouver's Mayor Gregor Robertson and the head of Canada's Mortgage and Housing Corporation, Evan Siddle, gave artificially low estimates of foreign ownership of Vancouver real estate, Yan was uncovering the truth. Finally, after 4 or 5 years, governments are catching up to Yan. What would have happened if they had listened years ago? Would there be more affordable housing today? Would money launderers and tax evaders be facing charges? You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 31st, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 31st in 1958, John Diefenbaker's Progressive Conservatives won 208 of the 256 seats in the House of Commons, as 79% of voters turned out for the general election, the biggest majority over all opposition parties in Canadian history. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.